perspective of ways.
He didn't really explain his shadow's desires, the blackness of its umbra, the way it controlled him, only that it kept him in the dark. Like all personal shadows, it was extremely difficult to discern the negatives, and in some ways, I was even fooled into believing that those negatives were actually positives for a very long time, he wrote. He wanted Wilding to know he had joined battle with his shadow. He hoped to win, but he couldn't be sure of victory. Like Jung, I don't believe that a person can fully extinguish their own shadows. Instead, it is best to take 100% responsibility for who we are and to integrate our shadows into our conscious awareness. Obviously, this is a difficult process, and it doesn't happen overnight. But it is a process that becomes much more obtainable once we learn to start questioning and rejecting the idea that our conscious thoughts and our egos are always in control and always right. Sometimes it's necessary to question the authority within. Wilding chided him for not providing details about this personal shadow of his. That is what this assignment called for, but I respect your right to decline, she wrote. Underneath his final sentence about questioning the authority within, she scrawled, Why? When? She wanted him to engage that question. She gave him 8.7 out of 10 points. Wilding found her new student interested and eager. He was older than most of the others in his class, but he was intelligent and engaged, joining in conversations. Years later, when she discovered his past, she would wonder about the lessons she taught him. She found him bright and insightful in class. He was one of those students, not always common in community college philosophy classes, who appeared to want to learn. But had she been providing him insight into who he was, or just an excuse wrapped in erudite modernist theory, a way to absolve himself of his actions? My own personal take is that referencing a Jungian archetype is a way for him to transfer guilt, she would say. Or the maneuver is a foil to point to his knowledge of the difference between right and wrong, all the while acting on the desire to prey on women and their fears, as well as their bodies. Paying for school was easy. His service in the military entitled him to benefits under the GI Bill. Each semester, the Veterans Benefits Administration sent Red Rocks $3,834.35 for tuition and fees. Each month, the agency sent him an additional check for $1,531 for rent. The amount, based on a housing formula, was more than he was spending to lease 65 Harlan Street. So, the United States government also paid for his gym, occasional meals at Hooters, and a subscription to the popular online video game World of Warcraft. When he needed more money, he turned to his shadow. For years, he had scoured the darkest corners of internet pornography in search of relief. Porn about bondage and sadomasochism. Porn about rape. Porn about old women. Porn about teenage girls. Porn about dangerously malnourished women, their bones poking from their skin like they were famine victims. He chased the profane, the prurient, the obscene. His computer screen displayed images that were increasingly violent and disconnected from reality. He masturbated constantly. The hunt for porn consumed him. He called it an addiction. His habit did nothing to sate the monster, but he figured out a way to make it pay. He began to build his own pornographic websites. At night, he would slip into the back room at 65 Harlan Street and get to work. He told his wife and friends that he was a web designer. But really, he spent his evenings trolling the internet for new obscene images and videos. He would post them to his own websites, with links back to the website where the material originated. When somebody visiting his website clicked a link leading back to the original website, he would get a small commission. It was affiliate marketing, one of the internet's most basic business models. Each month, he got checks from a German company that served as middleman between him and the affiliate sites. The money was wired in euros to his bank account at the Elevations Credit Union in Boulder. Checks trickled in. $520.57 for 1 month, $355.78 for another. He started dreaming bigger. Across the top of a sheet of paper on his desk, he wrote, "The plan." He aimed to boost revenue to $1,000 a month for one of his more popular sites, Anilos.com, which featured older women. He hoped to get the flow from one affiliate network up to a constant $2,000 a month. His strategy? Build ever more niche porn sites at a rate of one per week to find additional revenue streams. By catering to more and more obscure deviances, he could make real money. On MySpace, he listed his occupation as pornographer. He amassed a collection of more than 1.7 million images and videos, some for personal use, some to post on websites. He stored them on the hard drive of his computer in the back room. He downloaded a free software program called TrueCrypt, which he used to encrypt the files with mathematically complex algorithms. The best hackers in the world, including those at the FBI and the National Security Agency, considered TrueCrypt's technology nearly unbreakable. Years before, when he'd taken his aptitude test to get into the Army, he had qualified to study to become a cryptographer. Now he was one. He built dozens of websites designed to attract kindred shadows. His big moneymakers? SkinnyTeen.net, AbusedTeenWhores.com, GrannyPanties.net, HotTeacherSex.net. Other sites catered to rape, still others to incest. The sites featured women in grotesque poses, gagged, humiliated. Older, gray-haired women splayed on beds or engaged in sex with younger men. Others who looked dangerously young. One site, thinfetish.com, was designed to attract those sexually thrilled by emaciation. It was never enough. To keep the money flowing, he constantly had to find fresh images to add to his nest of websites. New material attracted new customers and kept old ones coming back. He told one friend that he was tired of cheesy porn. He wanted something more authentic, more real as he could get. A month after Masha left for Georgia, he plunged into modern romance, the internet dating scene. Like always, he made sure to prepare. He lined a shelf in his back room with modern-day pickup guides. He was a student of Neil Strauss's The Game, Penetrating the Secret Society of Pickup Artists, and Eric von Markovic's The Mystery Method, How to Get Beautiful Women into Bed. Both books describe the transformation of AFCs, Average Frustrated Chumps, into irresistible PUAs, pickup artists, able to bed any SHB, super hot babe. They revealed secret societies where experienced Lotharios met to swap seduction techniques. There was the tic-tac routine. Give her a tic-tac, describe yourself as an Indian giver who wants it back, and then kiss her. The dryer lint opening. Enter a bar palming a piece of dryer lint. Pretend to pick it off her shoulder, then ask, "How long has that been there?" and the benefits of a glow-in-the-dark necklace, the better to peacock and attract attention to yourself. In the PUA universe, women are targets. The books contained scripts to help the PUA home in. Some focused on verbal takedowns called negs. One example. If your target interrupts you, say, "Hello, I'm talking, geez," or, "Excuse me, may I finish my sentence first?" You then say to others in the group, "Is she always like that?" and roll your eyes playfully. Take the SHB down a notch, in other words, and it might confuse her enough to come on to you. It was practical psychology. To find women, he prowled online dating services like OkCupid. He browsed the casual encounters section of Denver's Craigslist, an endless churn of dick pics, amateur porn, and raw cries for sex, mostly from men. When a woman posted an ad looking for a dinner date, he responded with jokes about his humdrum life. "Was planning on staying in tonight and reading. I know, exciting. But I decided to peruse Craigslist and saw your post and thought it might be fun to go have a couple of drinks. About me. 32. 6'2", 220 pounds. Divorced. Well-read. Well-traveled. Confident. Funny. And a good conversationalist. Not expecting anything. Just wanting to go out for a bit. Don't smoke. Don't do drugs." The poster was an amateur photographer. He told her that he would love camera lessons. "I have a Canon Rebel XTI, and I suck at using it, ha ha. Maybe you can give me some pointers." He closed with a smiley emoticon. Some women found him menacing. He told a 28-year-old Denver woman that he preferred girls who were petite, dressed in sexy clothes, and wore lots of makeup. "Every girl has a rape fantasy," he told her. He scoffed when a 31-year-old date told him that she liked a sadomasochism club in downtown Denver called The Sanctuary. The club would host sex parties where men and women could engage in S&M with boundaries. A dungeon master controlled the level of violence. Everyone was required to have a safe word, which would bring an immediate halt to an uncomfortable act. Bloodletting and scat play were forbidden. "These people here don't know what domination is," he told her. But he did, and it drove his search for women. "I'd feel them out," he'd say. "I'd grab a girl by the back of the neck, by the hair. If they responded to that, then I knew. A woman he could dominate. He made those dates dress up in high heels and garish lipstick. Sometimes they begged him to fulfill their rape fantasies. He liked rough sex. "My thing was humiliation and basically degradation," he'd say. "But it was always consensual. The girls I treated with respect. I never abused them. Well, other than what they wanted." These sadomasochistic encounters didn't satisfy him, though. He had gotten to know the women. They were no longer targets. They were real people. "I could do all kinds of crazy stuff with a woman, a good-looking, attractive, intelligent woman that I liked a lot. But that was kind of the problem, too," he'd say. "I liked them, and I knew them. For whatever reason, that was a turn-off. I just didn't get the same thing out of it." Then, while scanning OkCupid one day, he came across a woman named Amy. She was a 33-year-old waitress at a swingers club in South Central Denver. Dark hair and straight bangs framed a round face with expressive, wide-set eyes. While waiting tables, she wore a schoolgirl outfit or a bikini. In her profile, she listed three adjectives to describe herself: devious, curious, and twisted. "My kind of girl," he thought. He messaged her. "I have to know," he said. How are you twisted? He picked her up at her place for the first date. They shot pool at a bar. She described him as a perfect gentleman, charming and witty. He left a glowing review of her on OkCupid. Not only is she gorgeous, she is also a highly sophisticated woman with a mind that moves at warp speed. You are one of the few people in the world that I can relate to, he wrote to her in one message. They did not date long, but they stayed in contact. She had trouble sleeping. He worked late maintaining his porn sites. They traded emails and messages throughout the night. He thought of Amy as a friend in the dark. She once told him about an incident at her apartment complex. While she was walking down a hallway, a man had jumped out and tried to grab her. She wrestled away. The guy will come back eventually. He isn't good enough yet. He will come back and succeed, he told her. Under different circumstances, it might even be him. The only thing that keeps me from being that guy that attacked you is my family and my life, he said. He told her he was a sadist and that he wanted multiple sex partners. He boasted about his porn sites. He described fantasies about violent, degrading sex. He said that women were masochists who wanted men to hurt and control them. Some women, he told her, enjoyed being raped. Some women like bruises all over from sex because they like sympathy from it, he told her. At times, he would apply the techniques he had learned from his pickup books. Once, when Amy didn't respond quickly enough, he sent her a message on Facebook. If you are open to talking, I'll be keeping my Facebook page up for a little while longer. If not, go fuck yourself with a giant wall socket-powered vibrator held up with a stack of books, which you probably never read. A good neg. Throw her off base, then close with another message revealing emotion and understanding. When we were together, I told you that I felt as if something was missing in my life. I've finally begun to scratch the surface in finding out what it was. It's complicated. But then again, people like us are complicated beings, much more than you realize, he wrote. In August 2010, he began seeing Carla, a 28-year-old from Denver. One day, he took her to Green Mountain Guns, a family-owned shop in a mini-mall. He showed her a pistol he was hoping to buy, a small black and silver 380 caliber Ruger. Later that month, on August 10th, he raped Sarah. After leaving Sarah's apartment, he pawned his and Masha's wedding bands. He went to the Department of Motor Vehicles and got a new driver's license. Then he made a final stop, Green Mountain Guns. Using his new license and paying $328.13 in cash, including the $200 he stole from Sarah and the money from the rings, he bought the Ruger. When he got home, he stashed a pair of Sarah's underwear in the black guitar amp in his bedroom. He texted a photo of his new gun to Carla. He had two trophies. In October 2010, he got a new roommate to help pay the bills, his younger brother, Michael. Anybody walking down the street could see they were related. He was 32, weighed 220 pounds, stood 6'2", and had blonde hair and hazel eyes. Michael was 30. Weighed 230 pounds, stood 6'2", and had sandy blonde hair and green eyes. They sometimes got mistaken for the same person. But the outward similarities concealed deep differences on the inside. They were family, but they weren't close. Sometimes he found Michael irritating. Michael loved sports, worshipped the Tennessee Titans, hung a giant Tennessee football flag in his room, visited the house's back room at least once a day to check on his fantasy football and basketball teams. He tried to warn Michael. Professional sports were for the weak-minded. They were a waste of time, made to dumb people down. That was the thing. Michael was a conventional guy. He'd served in the military after high school. Once out, he wanted to play college basketball. He found an outlet at York College, a small Christian school in a small town rising from the flatlands of southeastern Nebraska. After graduation, he didn't find much use for his business degree, so he moved back to Colorado and supported himself by delivering furniture. He decided to stake his future on the most regular of regular guy jobs. He enrolled in barber school at Emily Griffith Technical College in Denver. That was how he thought of himself, just a normal dude. He had a steady girlfriend, a church-going woman he knew from high school. They had a big group of friends. They liked going to restaurants and movies. His guiding philosophy was far less complex than his brother's. I'm just gonna live my life and find what makes me happy. Michael knew that his brother was different. Deep, deep guy. Very deep, is how he described him. He's smart as hell. His older brother didn't drink, didn't smoke, didn't do drugs. He doesn't have a lot of friends, Michael would say. I don't even think he has a best friend. His older sibling pretty much kept to himself, locked away in the back room at 65 Harlan Street with his computer. He never let Michael see what he was doing. He insisted they each maintain separate accounts. I don't look at his stuff, and I'm pretty sure he doesn't look into mine, Michael would say. Michael was impressed by his brother's brains, but there was something off about him. He lined the bookshelf with strange books about symbols, ancient religions, secret societies. He'd occasionally discuss weird conspiracy theories. His brother, he'd say, just didn't think like regular people think. As far as, like, normal society stuff, like, normal society way of thinking, he's, like, way out there. As an example, he'd point to the new woman his brother began seeing that fall. She was an out-there woman. Her name was Calixa Buckley, a pseudonym. She was 32. She had grown up in the San Miguel Basin, a region of broke mining towns and blank prairie in southwestern Colorado. She had joined the Navy when she was 18, but hated it, deserting after a year. She returned to Colorado, where she was arrested, accused of burglarizing a drugstore and gas station in the tiny town of Norwood. She wound up living with an older man named Chuck Travers, a pseudonym. They hopscotched through trailer parks and single-story motels in hardly their towns, dotting the deserts of Navajo country in eastern Arizona. Chuck got jobs as a mechanic. Calixa concentrated on writing a manifesto based on Hopi theology. She called it The Theory of Everything. Calixa and Chuck had been together for 13 years and considered themselves a married couple. They also embraced polyamory. Both would regularly date and have sex with other people. So it wasn't strange when Calixa took an interest in a man from Colorado who contacted her through Craigslist. At first, they conversed by email. Eventually, they switched to the phone. The conversations lasted hours. Movies, books, pillow talk. The two became closer than brothers, Chuck thought. Calixa decided to fly to Colorado to meet her new man in person. Chuck, a former Marine, had worked in signals intelligence. He considered himself skilled at vetting people. He had his own phone conversations with the Craigslist stranger. He found him intense, private. His final analysis? The man was intelligent, well-read, a sadist, and a megalomaniac. But safe enough for Calixa to begin dating. In October 2010, Chuck drove her to Sky Harbor International Airport in Phoenix, a six-hour round trip from their room at the Desert Inn just off Old Route 66 in Holbrook, Arizona. Population, 5,053. He picked her up at the airport in Denver for a two-week stay with him at 65 Harlan Street. She had high, sharp cheekbones, a thin face, and a narrow nose. Her hair was dark, curly, with long ringlets falling past her shoulders. Her eyes, which she sometimes lined with dark mascara, could appear almost sunken, menacing. She knew that the world was a complex place, filled with powerful and secret groups that exerted control over the masses. He'd found a woman who understood the world as he did. He felt a thrum of connection. "I like her a lot," he'd say. His brother Michael had the opposite reaction. Calixa unnerved him. He called her weird and organic and into conspiracy theories. She held long, hushed conversations on the phone that he overheard. She talked about alchemy and archetypes and the infinite. She hinted that she was a high-ranking member of a powerful secret society. One night, Michael went out with Calixa and his brother. His brother warned him that they had to be careful. Calixa was off the grid. Not even the government knew about her. She had no social security number. A discreet protective detail shadowed her. They even followed her to Colorado. Michael promised his brother not to reveal anything. "I don't want to end up dead." From what Michael understood, his brother thought he belonged to an elite, enlightened cadre who knew how the world really worked and used that truth to dominate the quotidian and the ordinary. Michael knew it sounded crazy, but he believed it. "I'll tell you right now, it's not like a bunch of bullshit," he'd tell people who doubted his older siblings' fevered diagrams of hidden societal power structures. "I know it's real from being around him. Like, it's not just a bunch of garbage." Michael knew, too, that his older brother shared with Calixa a deep interest in the occult. He consulted The Magus, a 19th-century grimoire on Kabbalah, the influence of the planets, and the natural magic of unctions, amulets, charms. He considered himself an expert in the Corpus Hermeticum, a collection of mystic writings dating from AD 200. He prided himself on being a discerning reader. He didn't much like a Christian, Neoplatonic rendering of the Hermeticum that he had read, he told one friend. "I've seen other versions on the web that have, at least in my opinion, better translations from the original Greek." He was fascinated with numerology. He filled notebooks with scrawls of pagan symbols. He hunted difficult-to-find texts for study. The 42 Books of Thoth, containing the entirety of Egyptian theosophy. He embraced modern science that supported his social theories, like The Superorganism by Bert Holdobler and Harvard's E.O. Wilson, describing the hierarchical societies of insects. Hypnotism intrigued him. He wanted to document his insights with a blog. He played around with different names for it. Hive Theory, That Which Is, Primal Mind, Tribe 2-0. His topic, he wrote to a friend, was spirituality, the occult, philosophy, etc. Pretty much just a regular blog with my thoughts on it. Calixa visited 65 Harlan Street again in November. This time, she stayed for a month. He hoped to build their relationship into something more permanent. For the first time since he'd met Masha, he felt an emotional connection. And he still wanted to have kids. "It's been a long, long time since I've been that much into a woman," he'd tell people. When he was with her, he was a different person. It astonished him. He didn't look at pornography. He didn't go out prowling. She kept him calm. The monster never stirred. Her and I were so compatible, and I was so comfortable with her that I didn't even think about it, he said. I had no reason to think of anything else. Calixa, though, had different ideas. She told him she wasn't interested in a deeper relationship. She had her book to write. Her husband abided in his desert solitude. It was time to move on. She turned, suddenly, unexpectedly, into an ex-girlfriend. She left on December 15th. He was alone again. She could have helped me, he thought to himself. Instead, she was like the woman in the song he used to play for his mother, Little Wing. That's all she ever thinks about, riding with the wind. On January 5th, he raped Amber. He hid another pair of panties in the back of his guitar amp. The cycle began again. Chapter 10. Good Neighbors. January 25th, 2011. Westminster, Colorado. Hendershot and Ellis had worked together a long time. They shared an old joke. In case of a particularly boring meeting, and there were plenty of those in the police business, the trapped person would ask for a favor. Send a text asking me to leave the meeting. Add 911 to make it seem urgent. It was a mutual escape plan, albeit one they had never actually deployed. So when Hendershot got Ellis's message, it even included the 911, Hendershot assumed it was a joke rescue mission. Hendershot had spent the morning at a mandatory training meeting in Westminster City Hall. Funny, Hendershot thought, but the next second, she realized it was no ruse. Ellis had big news. She told Hendershot she had just received photographs of the glove and shoe prints left at the scene of the attempted rape in Lakewood. The criminalist who uncovered the prints was a friend, Sherry Shimamoto. The pair had bonded at a 2-week training course at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. Shimamoto was part of the Blue Web, Denver's loose-knit network of law enforcement analysts. It made perfect sense that Shimamoto had discovered the prints. She had a thing about shoes. She owned 50 pairs, including 5 sets of Adidas Superstars, the 3 herringbone-striped shell toes coveted by sneakerheads around the world. Before she began doing police work, her favorite job had been working retail at Lady Foot Locker. Shimamoto held a degree in mathematics. But her shoe-philia had led her to specialize in shoe identification when she became a criminalist. Shoe prints weren't as good as fingerprints, of course. They weren't unique to a person. But with a little luck, they could tell a story about the bad guy that might help identify him. A shoe print could indicate a particular brand, a Nike or a Merrell, and certain marks, a nick on the heel, a wear pattern on the sole, a high arch, could leave behind impressions that a crime scene technician could link to an individual pair of shoes. To determine the origin of a shoe print at a crime scene, Shimamoto would spend hours on Zappos.com, the internet shoe superstore that featured lovingly detailed images of the soles, uppers, and sides of thousands of shoes. Or she would go to the local mall and hang out at shoe stores. It was all research to get her closer to the perpetrator. Shimamoto had searched for shoe prints when she arrived at the scene in Lakewood, dusting the floor around the bedroom and kitchen with a bichromatic powder that revealed traces of oil or dirt left by fingers or shoes. She found 4 distinct impressions that looked like they were made by a tennis shoe. She found another similar shoe print in the wet dirt outside the bedroom window. When she dusted the window to look for fingerprints, she found instead what she thought was a glove print. A glove with a honeycomb pattern on the palm. As soon as Ellis pulled up the images that Shimamoto sent her, she recognized the pattern. It matched the size and shape of the strange honeycomb marks that she had discovered on the railing behind Sarah's apartment. At the time, she wasn't sure what had made the marks. Now, she told Shimamoto, she knew. Shimamoto was so excited that she raced out to a Dick's Sporting Goods store, where she discovered a pair of soft, black Under Armour gloves. The fingers and palm featured a raised grip in the shape of a honeycomb. Next step, the shoes. Ellis examined the photo that her fellow criminalist Callie Gibson had taken after spray-painting the footprint behind Amber's apartment in Golden. They looked nearly identical to the ones that Shimamoto had lifted from the mud beneath the bedroom window in Lakewood. Matt Cole, Galbraith's partner, shipped an image of the prints to a shoe identification website for law enforcement. A match came back. The prints were from a pair of Adidas ZX700 mesh shoes. They first started selling in stores after March 2005. When Hendershot saw everything that the two criminalists had linked together, she knew. The man who attacked the woman in Lakewood on July 6, 2010, had to be the same person who had raped Doris and Sarah. Hendershot put in an immediate call to the Lakewood Police Department. It was the strangest case that Lakewood Detective Aaron Hassel had ever been assigned. He had been called out to an attempted rape at a home in a nicer neighborhood. The caller, a woman named Lily, reported that a man in a black mask had attacked her while she was sleeping. When she called out for help, the man had gone to another room to check if anyone was home. Lily seized the chance to escape. She dove out a window above her bed. She fell 7 feet and landed head first, cracking her ribs, breaking a vertebra in her back. In intense pain, she'd staggered next door to her neighbor's house and banged on a door to wake them. When police arrived, though, they found no signs of forced entry at the house. No pry marks on the doors, no window panes smashed. The doors were all locked. So, too, the windows. Hassel talked with 4 neighbors, none of whom had seen or heard anything unusual. Technicians recovered no DNA. There's no evidence anywhere, Hassel thought. That wasn't quite true. Shimamoto had turned up the shoe and glove prints. They didn't match anything that belonged to Lily, but neither did they point to any suspects, or even confirm that an attack had taken place. A gardener took care of Lily's yard. Workmen came to the house every now and again, and she had an elderly male friend who occasionally stayed at the home. Any of them could have left the prints. Lily presented her own mystery. She was a free spirit. She made all sorts of unusual requests. She called Hassel to report that since the attempted rape, her cat had scratched at people wearing black boots. Perhaps the police should be looking for someone with black boots. She felt this was information that could be useful to the investigation, he wrote. She had a Russian artist friend draw a sketch of the attacker based on her description, and asked Hassel to distribute it to the press. The drawing was of a man with a mask covering his face, except for a slit showing blue eyes and blonde eyebrows. There were no other features that would help a person recognize the man in the sketch. Hassel declined to hand it out. On another occasion, she asked Hassel to canvass gyms around Denver in search of a well-built, 6-foot-tall white man with blue eyes. That's going to be a lot of guys, he told her. More than 2 months after calling police, she suddenly remembered that a strange wireless network had popped up on her computer before the attack. It was named Pure Evil, she said. Finally, She asked Hassel for a hypnotist to interview her in a trance state. Hassel contacted an investigator for the Jefferson County District Attorney's Office who was a licensed hypnotherapist. The trio met on a windy day in October at the Lakewood Police Station, some 3 months after the attack. The investigator began the session with a common technique to induce hypnosis. "Imagine you're in an elevator," he told Lily. "You're going down, down, down." She stopped him. "No, I'm not," she told him. She had her own technique. "I'm walking through a meadow," she said. She asked the investigator to allow her to act as a medium. She could speak for the cats, the squirrels, and the trees who witnessed the attack. Under hypnosis, Lily described scenes she had not previously recounted, nor could have witnessed. She reported seeing how the attacker had snuck into her house through the garage, how he had stood and watched her through her windows. Lily's trance-induced insights did not impress Hassel, nor the investigator. "The investigator told me he did not feel it was a productive session," Hassel wrote in his report. Lily wasn't hurting the investigation, but to Hassel's mind, she sure wasn't helping. Lily was frustrated, too. She didn't put much faith in cops in general. A few months before the attack, she'd had a bad experience with the police in Lakewood. She liked to worship in front of a towering tree at a neighbor's house. When new owners moved in, they called police at the sight of a strange woman chanting and dancing in their new yard. The cops told Lily to leave. She filed a complaint against them for harassing her. On another occasion, after the break-in, she heard a sound at 3:30 in the morning outside the home where she was staying. She called the police. A Denver officer responded to the call. When he knocked on the door, he lifted up his flashlight by his shoulder. Lily thought he was holding the light in the same way in which the attacker had held his knife. She refused to let the officer in. The next day, she asked Hassel to investigate him as a possible suspect in the crime. Hassel declined. She was frustrated with Hassel. He was always telling her no. When she asked for a police artist to sketch her attacker, he refused. That's why she had turned to her Russian friend. The police weren't taking her seriously. "It's not that important. It's not that big of a deal," she recalled them telling her. "It is a big deal," Lily protested. "I know what he looks like. I know how he moves. I know a lot about him. I saw his eyes. I saw his body. I'm an artist. I'll help you." About a month after the attack, she was gardening. She spotted a wood-handled knife stuck in the ground near her back fence. She recognized it as coming from her own kitchen, a knife that she usually used to cut open watermelons. It must have been the knife the rapist had held. He must have stabbed it into the ground before he fled. Why hadn't police found it before she did? Why did she have to call to alert them to such an important clue? She complained about Hassel's lack of response. Lily's parents weren't happy with Hassel either. They hired a private investigator to sleuth around. The PI, a retired Denver police detective, turned up what looked like a scuff mark on top of the 6-foot-high wooden fence surrounding Lily's backyard, but not much else. Nonetheless, the find was a clear signal to Lily and her parents. Hassel wasn't doing his job. One day, Lily's mother came down to the station. She confronted Hassel. "Tell me the truth," she said. "Do you believe my daughter?" It was a tough question to answer. Hassel had grown up as a conservative Christian in a military household. His father, an Air Force veteran, repaired appliances. His mom was a school teacher. He'd gone to Cedarville College, a small Baptist school outside of Dayton, Ohio. Students at Cedarville were required to minor in Bible studies. Instructors taught creationism. The school's motto was alliterative and unambiguous about its mission: for the crown and covenant of Christ. There was not much room on campus for people who believed in telepathy and tree spirits. Hassel also knew that women could lie about being raped. Early in his career, he had responded to an apartment where a woman said she'd been attacked. She fought the man off, she said, by dousing him with pepper spray. Hassel found pepper spray all over the woman's bedroom, but other things bothered him. The woman said the man had ripped off her pants, but he found the jeans curled in a pile, as though someone had pulled them down and stepped out. Then he found a receipt indicating that the woman had purchased the pepper spray on the previous day. When he questioned her about his discoveries, the woman folded. She acknowledged that she made up the incident. Hassel also discovered that she had complained to neighbors about being attacked by a different man a few weeks earlier. He figured she had an insatiable need for attention. He cited her for filing a false police report. And yet, Hassel knew enough to know he didn't know everything. Just 7 miles up the road from Cedarville sat another private school that offered an education in what seemed like an alternate universe. Antioch College was the quintessential small liberal arts school. It stressed democracy, student governance, and social justice. Students were required to work in the community. Instructors did not give just grades. They delivered narrative evaluations. Antioch's motto: be ashamed to die until you have won some victory for humanity. Hassel had plenty of opportunity to hang out with Antioch students. He realized that you could be different without being deranged. It made him hesitant to judge Lily. A lot of people that I worked with said, "She's nuts." I didn't think she was. I thought she had unusual beliefs. With experience, he had also learned the dangers of calling a possible victim a liar. He didn't feel like he had made the wrong decision at the start of his career. False reports took up time and energy. But now that he was a detective, he realized that informants might not feel comfortable sharing tips if they feared being arrested for lying. Lakewood's top brass, in fact, discouraged arresting people for making a false report, except in extreme cases. And then there were the risks specific to sexual assault. Rape is already an underreported crime. Charging someone who has come forward and not been believed threatens to chill reporting further, allowing rapists to get away, maybe to rape again. It would fuel the myth that many women lie about being raped. In its training literature for police, End Violence Against Women International notes that false claims of rape often stem from serious psychological and emotional problems. They are probably best handled with appropriate referrals for social services rather than prosecution for filing a false report. Hassel developed a theory about what had happened in Lily's case. Lily told him that she had drunk an herbal tea before falling asleep. He had done research online and found information to suggest that strong doses of the tea had been linked to vivid dreams. The way he figured it, it was possible that she had awoken from a powerful vision and dove from the window before coming to. It was a way to reconcile the lack of evidence with Lily's statements without calling her a liar. He wavered, though. The mystery footprints and glove prints couldn't be easily explained away. And Lily's injuries were serious. Perhaps some monster had entered her home. Perhaps he was still out there. He had a hard time making up his mind. Still, with little evidence to go on, Hassel felt he had done everything he could. In October 2010, He stopped actively investigating the crime, but kept the file open, just in case new information surfaced later. His final entry? No viable leads. Sharon Whelan was a good neighbor. She and her husband, Gary, had lived in the Lakewood neighborhood of Applewood for 15 years. She taught arts and drama at local schools. He worked as a geologist. They raised three kids in their big five-bedroom home a block from the lake. They knew just about everybody. When a restaurant abutting the neighborhood tried to expand its size, they had helped lead the opposition. "It's a tight place," was how she described her community. She kept special watch on her neighbor directly across the street, 89-year-old Kathleen Estes, a widow. Late one summer Monday, on June 14, 2010, Whelan looked up and saw a white pickup parked by the side of the road in front of Estes's house. It struck her as odd. It was too late for workmen, and most people in the neighborhood parked their cars in garages or driveways. She called Estes. "There's a truck sitting out front. Is somebody visiting you?" Estes hadn't noticed the truck. Maybe it was somebody at another neighbor's house. They had teenagers. Their friends were coming and going all the time. "I'll watch it too," she told Whelan. A half hour later, Whelan was getting ready for bed. She glanced at the clock. It was 10:49 p.m. The truck was still in front of Estes's house. But now she saw a man in the cab. He seemed to be just sitting there, doing nothing. Her husband wrote down the license plate number. When Whelan called again, Estes decided to contact the police. She gave the dispatcher the plate number that Whelan's husband had written down, 935-VHX. When a Lakewood cop arrived a few minutes later, the truck was still there, but the man was gone. The officer walked around the pickup. It was a white Mazda. Nothing seemed unusual. He ran the license plate number. It came back clean. The officer knocked on Estes's door. He hadn't found anything wrong, he told her. Back at the police station, he created a brief entry about the encounter called a field interview report. He labeled it suspicious vehicle. Early the next morning, Whelan happened to look out her window. She noticed that the truck was gone. She stopped worrying about it. So did Estes. The neighborhood was back to normal again, and Whelan wouldn't think about the white pickup until she saw a local news broadcast 8 months later. In early February 2011, a Lakewood police detective walked over to a cubicle belonging to Danelle DiGiosio, one of Lakewood's crime analysts. He had been brought into the case to find more links between the attack on Lily and the other rape cases. At a briefing, he learned that the rapist had stalked the women and taken underwear from their homes. He knew that DiGiosio had all sorts of databases she could tap. Could she look for any burglaries where someone reported stolen underwear? He wondered. And could she do it by tomorrow? The task force was having a big meeting to review all the evidence in the case. DiGiosio almost laughed out loud. There were many things she could find using her data sets, but this wasn't one of them. "If I found my favorite underwear missing, I'd say it must be stuck in a pant leg somewhere, or the washing machine ate it. Not in a million years would I think to report it to the police," she told the detective. DiGiosio was used to being asked to do the impossible. She had grown up in a small town in the undulating agricultural plains near Greeley, Colorado. It was a quiet, safe place. She played volleyball and basketball and ran track for the Valley High School Vikings in Gilcrest, Colorado. But she had her heart set on joining the FBI. She enrolled at the University of Denver, hoping to get a degree in criminal justice. But a professor told her she needed an edge to get into the agency and suggested statistics. the FBI had started investing heavily in data analysis. Math was not DiGiossio's strongest subject. "I was really good at English. I liked music," she says. But she wanted a shot at law enforcement. If she had to study statistics, she'd study statistics. "I made myself like math," she says. And she was intrigued by the power of statistics to solve problems in the real world. She called it math with a purpose. She graduated in 1999, but never applied for an FBI job. Instead, she got a job training other police officers in how to use maps for crime analysis. She got married, had kids, and decided that she preferred stability over teaching and traveling. By 2008, she was working at Lakewood, one of the few criminal analysts in Colorado with a full degree in statistics. At Lakewood, she filled her desk with computer monitors, pictures of her kids, and a coffee pot. Across the room was an enormous printer that produced city maps on rolls that looked almost like butcher paper. The printer was her weapon of choice. She used it to plot out car burglaries and convenience store robberies, helping cops figure out how to stop them. "She might not have a database to examine underwear theft," she told the inquiring detective, "but she could use her mapping software to help pull every report of every suspicious vehicle and person logged within a quarter mile of Lily's house." "It's like finding a needle in a needle stack," she said, "but that's something I can do." By the end of the day, she'd found her needle, a record of the call Estes had made 8 months earlier when she reported the suspicious white truck parked in front of her home. The location and timing of the report stood out to DiGiossio. The date, June 14th, was only 3 weeks before the rapist struck Lily's house. And Estes's home was only a few blocks from Lily's home. She wondered. "Why are you there at this time of night? You don't belong there." The next morning, February 9th, 2011, Hassel and DiGiossio drove to the Westminster Police Department. When they walked into the room, DiGiossio was surprised. Some 2 dozen cops and FBI agents were gathered around a long conference table on the second floor of the station. Hendershot and Galbraith were there. So, too, Burgess and Grusing. It had been 35 days since Amber's rape. The news was not great. Galbraith had pulled the cell phone records for her chief suspect, Frank Tucker, the college student who had been accused of sexual assault. He turned out to have been skiing in Vail when Amber was raped. And when he was brought in for questioning, he showed off the splotch on his calf that Amber had thought might be the birthmark she saw on her rapist. It turned out to be a circular, blue flame tattoo. The FBI's VICAP program had also failed to deliver. Grusing and Galbraith had talked with detectives in Lawrence, Kansas, who had investigated the chain of rapes that had plagued the college town. The possibility of a connection was tantalizing. But the Kansas investigators had run into the same problem now facing the room full of cops in Colorado. They were able to connect the rapes, but they had not identified a suspect. Lewis, the analyst from the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, reported on the results of the testing that Hendershot had requested, comparing Westminster's DNA sample to Aurora's and Golden's. They had only one shot. The testing procedures had destroyed the few cells that had been recovered. But they found that the DNA samples were, indeed, linked. The evidence wouldn't be useful in identifying a single individual, but now the detectives had concrete proof of what they all suspected. The same man, or men from the same family, had raped Doris, Sarah, and Amber. Sergeant Trevor Matarazzo, the Westminster cop in charge of dealing with the media, realized that he was going to have to tell a crowd of reporters about a serial rapist loose in Denver's suburbs. And he would have to admit that the police had no clue as to his identity. Thoughts raced through his head. How should police tell the public? What clues could they give